I really encourage anyone out there who's considering making queer content, if you like get the vibe from mainstream that it's hard to fund this or blah, 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 just don't listen. Make it micro, do it, and there'll be a market for it if you make something good.
Shoot responsibly.
This is Adam Shartoff, and you're listening to FilmWax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of FilmWax Radio, the independent film talk show. I hope you're well. I'm well. I am. I'm doing pretty well. I wanted to just let everybody know that on Monday, this Monday, June the 16th, I'm going to be doing a live podcast at the Northside Film Festival at the Nighthawk Cinema. Doors are at 7 o'clock. We start the event at 7:30. And my guests are going to be the co-directors of the movie Fort Tilden. It was a big hit at South by Southwest, and they are now premiering, at least in Brooklyn, at the Northside Film Festival. They're going to come on to this live podcast. And their names are Sarah Violet Bliss and Charles Rogers, and I'm looking forward to meeting them. And then also on the panel is Colin Healy, who directed a film called Homemakers, which was, an IFP Labs alum. Also, it was an award winner at the Independent Film Festival of Boston just recently. So I'm really excited to welcome those filmmakers, as well as my friend and returning to the podcast, Alex Malice, who you may remember is one of the Brooklyn Filmmakers Collective, as well as also being involved in Keith Miller's film Five Star. He interviewed a few of the people from that film and some other guys for this short documentary called After Trayvon, and that will be showing at the festival as one of the shorts. And Alex will be also on the panel. And also, lastly, I'm going to be talking to Sarah Lerner, who has been involved with the Northside Festival since its inception 4 years ago. All that happening again at Monday. No, there is no cost, but you need to go to, I guess you can go to Eventbrite, the website, and search Northside Festival, or you can search FilmWax, I suppose, or you can go to the Northside Film website and go to the film schedule, and it will be there under the Monday evening, and then there's a place to register for the event. It's a very limited capacity seating there. Anyway, I'm plugging that event. This is the second live podcast. I hope it's the second of many to come. They're fun to do, and they just are very engaging, interactive, etc. I look forward, and it gives me a chance to meet folks, and I love that. So today's podcast is exploit the fact that it's Pride Month. It's June. So the next couple episodes are going to incorporate that. The film Test, which is directed by Chris Mason Johnson, who will be on this episode momentarily, he shot this. It takes place in San Francisco in 1985. It's not using any real well-known actors in it. That may not be the case at some point soon, but right now they're not. So it gives it a very much more sort of almost a documentary feel to it. It was an official selection at the Berlin International Film Festival, at the Seattle International. It was a winner for Outstanding U.S. Dramatic Feature at Outfest, by the way. So it's been doing quite well, and the reviews have been coming in, have been very strong for this movie, and it's called Test. And I believe it opened June 6th in San Francisco, and as well as going on demand on June 6th. This past Friday. Well, on this coming Friday, June the 13th, it's opening in New York and Los Angeles. So Chris will be on in a few moments. Also coming up later this week is going to be the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. And from that festival, I'm going to be bringing on filmmakers Rachel Beth Anderson and Tim Grusha with their film First to Fall. It's going to be at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival. We'll have all the details for you shortly. First up here, though, is my conversation with Chris Mason Johnson, and then we'll be back after that to talk a little bit about First to Fall.
Dance like a man. In your feet, in your hands, in your neck.
Mm-hmm. on tonight?
I'm just warming up.
You'll go on. Don't worry.
People didn't want to touch Malcolm.
But you can't get it from sweat, can you?
I've been feeling a little dizzy lately.
We can do a test on your inner ear. But sometimes a virus can linger in there and affect your balance.
A virus?
There's a test for it now.
But if you had it and they found out, they could do something with the information, couldn't they? Like a quarantine or put your name on some list?
It's supposed to be confidential.
It sounds right. Better than anything else that I've done. So audio-wise, because I'm real stickler and...
If you get it to sound good, it can compete with, you know, anything.
Right, yeah. Exactly.
It's the same with movies.
Right, exactly.
Right. This was the whole thing, including our festivals, was 200,000.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's insane to do, period.
Right.
Are we recording?
We are recording. So we can leave the budget part out if you want.
Oh, actually, now that we're all sold and distributed,
oh, yeah,
I don't
it doesn't
mind.
Really matter. Right. But it's funny, Chris Mason Johnson.
Johnson, yeah.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. The movie's called Test, and it's already playing in San Francisco, just to get some of this business out of the way. But it is opening in New York and in Los Angeles on
New
the
York 13th. And L.A. and like over a dozen cities through Variance and Wolf and all
great,
that info
great partners
on
there.
The website, testthefilm.com.
Right. Yeah, I just started following your Twitter, and I posted saying, anticipating your arrival here in Brooklyn. But we're
Facebook
just,
too, of course.
Yes, of course. Test the film.
Facebook.com/test.
What we were just talking about right before we interrupted ourselves to...
That it can... If you can get it to look right or sound right with minimal money, then it can compete aesthetically with anything.
Yeah, exactly. It's the threshold is what it is now, and it's not so costly to reach the threshold. A Zoom recorder like I use sounds, on a good day, it can sound as good as when I was recording out of a studio, which I talk about occasionally. But
yeah, and it's the same with the camera. We used a Sony F3, which is like the poor man's Red or the poor man's Alexa. But if you have a DP who knows what he's doing, you know, you have a little less latitude. Is what he tells me. I have a vague idea of what that means. But if you know what you're doing, people think it's a $3 million movie, sure.
Yeah, it looks terrific.
Thank you.
Really does. Do you want to talk about the synopsis of the film?
Oh, sure.
I did a little bit of my intro, but it's nice
to hear. Yeah, it's set in 1985 in San Francisco in a dance company. We usually say modern dance, even though for dance people that's not completely accurate. But I can explain that. But anyway, it's 1985, San Francisco Dance Company. It's the early sort of panic days of the AIDS epidemic when people don't know if they can get it from sweat, if they can get it from food. They don't want to eat if there's a gay waiter there. Gay waiters are being fired just because they're gay, all that stuff.
Right.
So it's those early panic years. And it's really about a young male dancer who's an understudy, classic story, goes on, has a big night, performing fantastically. And it's, in terms of the epidemic, it's about his fear, right? So most movies that deal with AIDS have been about death and dying, understandably. But this is really just focuses on the fear, you know, so it's a different slice of that story.
Right. I was trying to remember at a certain point, do you actually use the term AIDS in the movie?
Well, it's graffitied on an abandoned mattress. It says, AIDS, faggot, die, which was actually graffiti I saw in the late 80s. I saw it smaller on a wall, but I took that, I put it on a mattress, and the character walks by it in the movie.
Is the term spoken, though, at any point?
The term is not spoken ever, and that's interesting. I mean, it's good you mention that, because that's like part of the whole premise, is that these are not comfortably out characters. They're super young, in their early, mid-20s, and they're not verbal. So, you know, most of the other dramas, we just saw The Normal Heart on HBO, etc., they're very verbal, and they're about verbal men in their 30s and 40s who... talk about what's happening, and that's how you usually dramatize things,
they
by talking.
They also have, for being, you know, somewhat evolved, you know, they have a vocabulary, you know,
right.
And
they have a community, etc., vocabulary.
Yeah.
And these characters are mute, so that was cinematically something I wanted to do, which is like a visual depiction. I mean, a tone poem is sometimes used. That maybe that sounds pretentious to people, but you know, it's a European tradition more than an American to do a very visually oriented narrative. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite examples of that is Krzysztof Kieslowski's Blue with Juliette Binoche. Mm. You know, and it's just, I hear that he wrote that with his DP as kind of an image by image writing, as opposed to scene where people talk by scene where people talk. You know, so that was sort of my model in writing.
I mean, I can look at you. You were too young in the 80s to remember.
I remember some of it. Like, I mean, I was there. I was a teenager. I danced in the late 80s and early 90s. But yeah, I was younger than the characters. I am younger than the characters, but I have vivid memories, and then I supplemented those with research, for sure.
Did you talk to people that were, I guess, that would be obviously the most obvious way to do it?
Yeah, talking to people, tons of dancers, and there's a lot of resources out there now around this.
Yeah.
And the epidemic, in terms of how it affected the dance community, went through the 90s, obviously, so I do also draw on my own memory.
Oh, yeah, so talk a little bit about that in your own relationship. You are in the film, right? As a...
I'm uncredited, yeah. I don't...
Oh, you are?
Yes.
Okay, well, I just gave you credit.
as the nasty choreographer.
Right. Talk about your history as being a dancer, and when did you transition to film? What was that?
I started dancing professionally very young, like at 17, and then I did that for a number of years and then went to college, went to Amherst College back east here, and I always knew I wanted to move into film, you know.
Did you?
Yeah, performing, acting, and then dance, but mainly dance was, you know, it's one of those things in life where you don't plan on it, but you're just suddenly... dancing in a ballet company, which sounds weird.
Was it a classical company?
It's contemporary ballet is like the right like nuance to it. It means it's not classical where you have tutus and boring story ballets, but nor on the other end of the spectrum is it like Merce Cunningham barefoot abstraction. So it's sort of that middle ground that... I mean, it's been a little popularized, a little vulgarized by the sort of "so you think you can dance" aesthetic, but there's some really great work on those shows, actually, and that's probably the closer aesthetic. So you're ballet trained, classically trained, but then what you're doing is not classical ballet.
Gotcha.
Right.
Yeah, it's not the Balanchine school. It's something else.
Right.
Right, but it's not modern.
Gotcha. No.
Right. Understood. And so you were a high school student doing this at high school, or are you doing this on your own time after school and on weekends?
I did it at high school. I had a great dance teacher in high school.
What school were you going to for high school?
Was it in Santa Monica?
Was it in like an arts high school?
Or? No,
really,
it was just, you know, I guess lucky.
They must be very proud.
She
turned out pretty well.
Honestly, it was like a big city, LA. I don't even know if they know, but yeah. And then I went into training outside. I went to New York and I was at School of American Ballet and then started dancing with the Feld Ballet.
Okay. And it's interesting because there have been in the last few years some you know, number of films that are about ballet or dance, I should say.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like they finally know how to make a kind of a mainstream commercial film with dance in it that looks very compelling. You've done a spectacular job. I mean, when I was watching those scenes, I didn't even realize it till after the film, and I was like, I really watched when those scenes were happening. Those guys were dancing. It was intense. Your lead actor,
Scott Marlowe.
Scott Marlowe. It's unbelievable. I mean, he's just sensational.
As a dancer.
As a dancer.
Yeah,
well, of course, but he...
When he does his solo, you're like, wow, that kid can dance.
Yeah. And they all do. Yeah. I mean, but yeah, he's an amazing, great, talented guy. And also just shooting, dancing, I guess, is not just point a camera at a bunch of dancers. I mean,
No, that's the trick of it. I mean, as a dancer, I think probably most dancers have really strong opinions about how dance is filmed. And it's like you want this fine line or this balance between respecting the whole body so you can see it, mm-hmm. framing the whole body with real duration. And that goes back to Fred Astaire, and he always insisted on that. A balance between that on the one end and on the other, you know, cutting for dynamics, because otherwise it would look boring and old-fashioned if it was so static, just like a filmed stage thing, you know. And Fosse was really a master of that in Cabaret, the way he cuts those dances. I think Milos Forman did a great job of it in Hair with Twyla Tharp's choreography. You know, there's other examples. The famous one, of course, is The Red Shoes, mm-hmm. which is a Powell Pressburger movie and is on Martin Scorsese's top 10 favorite films of all time.
Oh, yes.
As well as mine. It's a great movie.
Also whenever there's like a series about, you know, dance films, it's always included.
It's always included.
It's always in there.
But yeah, so that was really important. We had a theater in San Francisco for like 4 or 5 days. It wasn't long. And we just put that camera on stage on wheels, right? So it was like a dolly without tracks because the stage was smooth. So we could really push it around the dancers and get a dynamic feeling.
Get a choreograph. That with the dance.
Yeah, and that's what I love. I mean, I call my DP the human dolly, and but it's like he's another dancer, and as a director, which is not dissimilar to being a choreographer, you're blocking bodies is a lot of what you're doing, and the camera becomes a body. So it's really about the relationship of all those moving parts, and having a dance background is really helpful for that. And you know, there's a history of choreographers who become filmmakers going all the way back to the 30s and all the way up to today. So I think it's kind of like a natural, the art forms are kind of naturally, I don't know if symbiotic's the right word, but like naturally complementary.
Mm-hmm. In your mind, were you trying to draw some sort of symbolic or metaphorical relationship between dance and the AIDS panic?
Yeah, I mean, that goes back to the earlier point about the characters being relatively mute. Mm-hmm. If I don't have people talking about it, then I have to dramatize it visually. And if I'm and the way to do that is through the body. So the body is the site of disease, of course, and fear, and you see characters checking their skin in the mirror for signs. But it's also the dancing body. The body is also that which has sex, right?
Yeah.
So it's eroticized, it's sexualized, it's aestheticized, it's the site of disease. So it all comes back to the body in how the story is told. And the dance gave a perfect way to do that. And I remember we were doing a tech or a dress on stage, and we hadn't shot the dance yet, and we were trying out costumes, and they had different kind of t-shirts and different kind of shirts, and then it was like a light bulb, take your shirts off, you know, which could be cheesy, you know, the shirtless mm-hmm. sexy guys can be a cheesy trope in like bad gay film, but for this it was perfect because they do all the dance shirtless, and you know, it's so much about their flesh and the vulnerability, and it was definitely about that.
And you've been playing a lot of festivals.
Oh, yeah.
The film
gosh.
Has really been getting a lot of traction in that.
A full year. You know, I showed an early cut at the Edit Center in New York to Alan Oxman, who I went to college with. He still is Todd Haynes' editor. And he said, you know, that was really good. And he told us, cut this one scene, and we did. But then he said, you know, that's really good. And I don't say this to a lot of people, but just go wide, hit as many festivals as you can. You know, usually you try to do the Toronto Sundance strategy,
right.
And all
yes,
that.
Yes, yes, the major festivals.
And we did that, festivals. But he also said, just go wide, and because there's no stars in it, but it's really right. good, and it's going to take time to find an audience, but people will like it, and just sort of build that. And he was right on with that advice. That's what we did, and it took a while. I mean, it was a slow start. We premiered at Seattle, but then we went to Outfest and won 2 Grand Jury Awards there. And then we did more festivals and more festivals. And then, like, lo and behold, Berlin came through. So that's really
that's
big.
Huge. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we, you know, got distribution throughout Europe and in the U.S. And
mm-hmm. Well, talk about deciding not to cast any recognizable.
Well, deciding is a generous way of putting it. I mean, you know.
Well, the other decision is not to make a movie.
Right, exactly. Also. No, I mean, when you do a micro-budget thing like this, with young leads, you know, if I had, and I hope I do one day, write a script for a middle-aged woman, for example, then even if you have $200,000, you can still go out to Sissy Spacek or whomever because they're looking for that material. But this is like 22-year-old guys, and they had to be dancers, you know, so I couldn't cast actors. I had to cast dancers. It's like, you know, people can carry a tune, but they can't sing opera. And lots of people can dance. I love John Travolta in Saturday Night Fever and Hairspray. But I love it when he does that.
Yes.
But this is like the opera of dance. So I had to cast dancers.
Yeah. Yeah. That's good. Yeah, glad to give props to John Travolta in Hairspray.
In Hairspray, yeah, he does that. When he does that wide stance stomping move as whatever her name is, Edna or something.
Yes.
He's just a great dancer, you know. He really is.
Yeah. Let's talk about also Variants, because I'm kind of curious to know as a distributor.
Mm.
And then Wolf is the is doing the digital stuff, or is what has
Wolf
that
does DVD, and internet, VOD,
the digital platforms,
right? All
and non-theatrical.
Yeah, but I mean, ironically, that's really where our bread is buttered as independent filmmakers. I mean, that's where the revenue comes in. Mm-hmm. I mean, I just saw something in IndieWire the other day about, you know, is the industry going to get transparent about VOD numbers? Are we going to start to learn what those are? Because that's the real distribution in a sense.
Right.
I mean, the theaters...
For non-studio movies.
Non-studio movies. The theaters totally matter, and the way it works that I just learned on this movie, because my last movie was in theaters in 2009, and that's the new 20, and the day and date model wasn't even like a model yet, as far as I know. So the way it works is you do this small theatrical, and we're like a dozen cities, little art houses, and because you do that, you get the press. And if you're lucky, like we were, we got really good press. And then that press sort of acts as the marketing engine for on demand, and it also makes you exist in the world, you know. You know how it is, right? Otherwise, you might just fly under the radar.
You have reviews now and
features, reviews. I mean, it's all on the website if people want to find it, testthefilm.com. But so that really worked for us well. And then it becomes really, and this is why a lot of theaters won't book day and dates. Like the Landmark theaters won't book day and dates. I mean, I guess I heard Harvey Weinstein like pressured the Angelica, I don't know if this is true, it's what I heard, to take Lovelace, which was a day and date because he's Harvey Weinstein, but normally the Angelica wouldn't take a day and date. And you can understand why, because the on-demand, you know, pulls revenue from the theatrical.
Sure.
But this is what audiences want. You know, we all got our flat screens, we got iTunes, we got our widgets, we got our whatever, and we want the option. So I think it's the wave. You can't...
Yeah, I got to bring somebody on from one of those, from one of the Landmark or Angelicas, because I really am curious to know just like how much they're riding so close to the vest financially with these films that they can show that day and date is hurting their business.
I mean, I would believe it if it were... I mean, just with the new 20, which was my first film, and it got some solid reviews, and it got an award out of Outfest, it wasn't as well received as Test. But we opened at the Quad, and...
Well, did you forewell it?
No, we did not. They booked us, and we... our numbers were like 8, 10,000 for the weekend, which put us in like the top 5 per screen grosses that weekend. You know, and we made no money theatrically.
Yeah.
But... if we had been on demand, I don't think that would have happened. But it's also hard to say because movie-going habits have changed so much. You know, I think people went to the movies a lot more in 2009. And, yeah.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that was pre-tablet or pre-iPad.
Is that pre-iPad? 2009?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's only five years ago. We're talking like it's.
Yeah, I know.
We're talking like it's two decades.
I was talking at length ad nauseum with Jonathan Couette. You know? Do you know Jonathan?
We've like Facebooked each other, but I know his work. Yeah, I love that movie.
Yeah, Tarnation, and so I have actually an episode that I'm putting up because he's doing a series up at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you live. You're living in Manhattan still?
In San Francisco, New York.
Oh, okay,
yeah,
gotcha.
Go back and forth.
Anyway, if you're around later in the month, I don't know. You might be, or you probably have to, you know, be on a bit of a road show. But he's doing a bit of a personally curated little film series at the Wythe Hotel in Williamsburg. They have a beautiful screening room. And we were talking about how the technology and the special, it's so exponentially, not only everything becomes so much more widespread and ubiquitous in terms of technology and accessibility and all that, but
right.
it's just happening so quickly.
So quickly.
Whereas technology used to really be slow. Like, I'm not going to go into much more detail about this, but like one day, okay, after, you know, living 30 years, we have an answering phone. I'm talking about obviously back in 70s, 80s.
I don't know.
And then all of a sudden, like 10 years later, they say, you can call in remotely to your answering machine now.
Right,
and it's like,
right.
This just changed your life because all of a sudden you don't have to be home to get your phone messages.
Or the
that
Walkman is in test. It's like he carries a Walkman around. It was like the first,
exactly.
The first
really
portable
great
music. Yeah.
Exactly. A really
Although,
great
I don't know. I mean, it's like whatever era we're in, we think things change quickly. I mean, if you take the long view, a couple hundred years with Industrial Revolution, with railroads, I mean, when I fly back and forth from New York to LA, I'm like, this is insane. I mean, mm-hmm. wagons, just however many, 150 years ago, whatever, you know, and the Donner Pass and cannibalism. I mean, you know, if you take the big picture, the changes have been fast since the Industrial Revolution, probably. But yeah, in our micro lives, it feels insane.
Yeah.
And so many jobs are being destroyed and so many things are opening
up. Well, that's the thing. I mean, I there has to be a much more in-depth look into what I'm speaking of because I am speaking out of my butt. But,
exactly.
But,
me too.
However, but that's the other part of it is that I don't believe that it changed in such a quick pace that it changed the very every industry that we know so quickly.
No, it did. It did. For example, textile industry, there was a huge culture of home weavers in England. I mean, every fabric was woven by human beings, and suddenly there were factories making fabric.
Yeah.
So that's very comparable to iTunes destroying the music industry, actually.
Also, phonographs killing the piano industry, because everybody in order to would have a piano in their home, and everybody would play around the piano because they didn't have phonographs.
So we gotta just ride the wave and see what happens. There's an interesting book called Who Owns the Future about possible new models for monetizing all this stuff we do for free on the internet, which is one possible solution.
If you're talking about where people voluntarily pay for content, is that what you're talking about?
Voluntarily pay for content, but also
you give them the option.
Yeah.
I mean, I need to do that.
Yeah, he goes into a few different strategies. But it's a problem, and we're in the middle of it.
Yeah.
But, the optimistic side is I can now take this camera and make a movie that looks like cinema, you know? And
let me just modify, if I may, and say you made cinema. it just democratizes it.
Right. And we still have the same problems we always had in terms of, this is why YouTube is full of cat videos, which I enjoy, by the way. And that is, I really do, it's bad. But, and that is, we still have to make content. You still have to sit down and write a story.
Yes.
You know, you have to, there's still that.
Oh, and as somebody who watches 100 films, you know, for one festival every year, there is a lot of flawed films, you know.
Right.
But. Because there are people looking through them, and they're protecting you, the movie-going public. The best does, I believe, rise. I don't just say that. I do believe it. Mostly the best rises to the top, unless you have millions of dollars of marketing budget to put up posters everywhere, as do many of the studios. But, you know, and then it did create this niche for people like me, thank you, because the average person who might be interested in non-studio films as well, but don't know where to begin because they don't
there's
know.
So
there's
many.
So many, the proliferation of independent cinema. There are people that can help along the way, a little bit.
And curating.
I hope that's, yeah, you're a little bit for you. And I kind of feel like that's where I found a place to some degree, you know, in that space.
That makes sense. But
I was very interested in, just learning a little bit more, because I know, like, Variance and Wolf are known, and you know, for taking on films that have a social sort of a social significance to them.
Yeah, and Dylan at Variance, and which is now, I think, Amplify, they merged with a digital company, so they're covering now the whole range of distribution. He has great taste. And he's carved out in the theatrical side of things an interesting window where independent films need these theatricals, and if you just book a couple cities and that's it, then nobody even notices. So you need to have some marketing, you need to spend a little bit of money, you need to have more than just two theaters, but you're not a studio, you know, nor are you whatever, Fox, what's the little one they have?
Searchlight?
Yeah, Searchlight. So it's this small model that he's carved out that's really viable and valuable. And then what Wolf has done is it's LGBT content. And this is sort of something that's interesting because it cuts both ways. On the one hand, I make this quote-unquote gay film, and it's ghettoized, and people don't take it seriously because, frankly, there's a lot of bad gay films out there that are just kind of pandering product that nobody, you know, that don't rise out of that niche. Mm-hmm. So you're ghettoized on the one hand, but on the other hand, and this is important for anyone listening who wants to make LGBT-themed content, there's a market. You know, Wolf buys these films, and there's distributors in Germany, Profun, in France, in UK, Peccadillo, in all the major Western countries. There are distributors who pay real money for gay content, and they're looking for quality because so much of it isn't good. And on the other hand,
make a good film.
Make a good film. Point. But on the other hand, you have an indie, even with stars, that goes to Sundance even, but just doesn't quite break through that magic level of being some kind of hit. And they make no money because no distributor picks them up. So, you know, my little movie for $200,000 has been bought by all these distributors, you know, and I'm not getting rich off of it. But by any means,
make your money back, or your investors get their money back.
Yeah, exactly. We'll recoup, which is like huge for an independent film. Sure. It's got to be like one in 10,000.
It's got to help make the next one too.
Yeah. So I really encourage anyone out there who's considering making queer content, if you like get the vibe from mainstream that it's hard to fund this or blah, 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 just don't listen. Make it micro, do it, and there'll be a market for it if you make something good.
Shoot responsibly. You mentioned
I want other filmmakers
with a very unconventional approach to
to funding the movie. Yeah, I want other filmmakers to know about this because I think it's really it's valuable information. And that is, you know, documentary filmmakers, as far as I know, I'm not a documentary filmmaker, you know, form nonprofits so they can get grants, etc. But fiction filmmakers don't do that. But I said, why not? You know, I have some worthwhile social content in here because it's dealing with the AIDS epidemic historically. It's a fiction film. I formed a nonprofit, had a good lawyer who just helped me do that with the IRS. It wasn't that complicated. It didn't cost anything. And then I was eligible for grants, right? Simultaneously, I did what all filmmakers do and form an LLC. So half the movie was funded from grants, which don't have to recoup, and half the movie is funded from the typical private equity, which does recoup on their investment. So that means, you know, my investors are much more likely to make their money back because it's only half the budget, and it means it opened up a world of grants. Now, I did a blog post about this in Hope for Film, Ted Hope's blog. So maybe people can find that, or maybe you can link to it.
I will
on
link
Facebook.
To it on
there. Yeah.
Well, and in my show notes.
Yeah, and you have to deal with a lot of like flack from people like, oh, you're a nonprofit, so you don't plan on making any money. You know, so there's this perception that film is this big business. But nonprofits, think about it. Every off-Broadway theater is a nonprofit. Every dance company is a nonprofit. You know, so there's a solid context for low budget arts being in that in that world.
Right, and this is Sirius Productions.
Sirius Productions Inc. is my nonprofit. Like I said, I did the LLC so I could still do investment for those people who had hopes for independent film investment. You can still provide that opportunity, but for others, you know, and Kickstarter is donation based, and then I was able to give my Kickstarter supporters tax deductible receipts, which normal Kickstarter people can't do.
Right.
through my nonprofit.
Wow. Yeah. Great. That is a very
innovative model. Check it out. Think about it.
The film again is called Test, and for more information go to testthefilm.com or Test the Film on Facebook or on Twitter to remain up to date on all things Test.
We're on iTunes now. We trended in the top 15 for independent films nationwide after just San Francisco. So we're hoping with New York and LA we push up into the top 10.
Oh, that's great. Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's really exciting for a small indie filmmaker to be on iTunes. It's like, you're real, you know, and Netflix too, of course, but you're suddenly available nationwide.
Right.
I mean, it's so easy to be cynical about technology because, like we were saying before, it happens so fast. Or not cynical, but jaded. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, yeah, big news. But come on, think about it. That's big news. I'm suddenly available nationwide. You know, you had to work really hard to make that happen physically.
Yes.
30 or 40 years ago with how many thousands of prints and thousands of theaters.
It's true. Life has changed.
It's magic.
As we have said. It is. Thanks so much, Chris. It was really nice meeting you.
Nice meeting you.
The Human Rights Watch Film Festival runs here in New York from June 12th through the 22nd. It's going to be occupying both Lincoln Center as well as the IFC Center, so they'll be doing screenings uptown and downtown. The festival includes many, many great films. One is Madeleine Sackler's Dangerous Acts, starring the unstable elements of Belarus. I've seen it, so I'm going to talk about the ones I've already seen. Evaporating Borders by Eva Radivojevich. Eva's been on this podcast before, and I'm hoping that she'll come back to talk about Evaporating Borders. First of All, which is the film we're going to talk about just shortly with the filmmakers, which, by the way, will be playing on June 17th and 18th. We're going to talk more in details about where it's... You can go to ff.hrw.org. That's FF as in Film Festival, .hrw as in Human Rights Watch, .org/New-York. Or just Google it, and it'll come up, and you can get all the details as well as, of course, tickets for various screenings that are going to be in the festival. With some others here. It looks spectacular, but I've only seen a handful of these films. To Be Decay, I think I mentioned the last show. Jennifer Crute is the filmmaker. It follows the actor and gay rights activist George Takei, of course, as well as, of course, he's probably best known, I'm going to guess, for his Facebook posts. Anyway, lots to see at that festival. So without much further ado, let's go right to my conversation with Rachel Beth Anderson and Tim Grucia and their film, First of All. And then we'll be back after that with The Wind Down.
So strewn all over the
well,
ground.
That's what makes it the difference. You know? So, what's your last name?
My last name is Grucia.
Grucia, got it.
Yeah.
Petals falling. Yeah. There's somebody up there throwing them.
Yeah, he must be out of lightning bolts.
Grucia. Grucia. It sounds Eastern European.
It's Polish.
It is Polish.
Yeah. Okay. Grucza, and the CZ makes the ch like
right.
Czechoslovakia.
Got it. Oh, well, yeah. That's a good way to remember it.
Yeah.
Tim.
Yeah.
Correct.
The phonetic is Grucha, pronounced like while waving a fist in the air. Like, Grucha!
I don't think a lot of people are probably doing that.
You'd no,
be
no,
surprised.
No. Just call my producers.
Oh, really? Demanding. And he's a tyrant behind the camera. Oh, that's good. It came. Whatever your methods were, they worked pretty well, I saw. And Rachel Beth Anderson as well.
Yes. Hello.
The director, co-directors. And the film's called First to Fall. And in the Polish, it is... We'll figure that out. No, I'm kidding around. I'm just joking.
I can tell you in French.
The film is having its U.S. premiere of First of All, brilliant, at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival in New York. It's going to have how many screenings?
Two screenings.
One at Lincoln Center, one at IFC Center?
Yeah. 17th at the IFC Center and the 18th at the Lincoln Center.
Well, that's coming right up.
Mm-hmm.
It means I have to edit and post rather quickly. What's today? It's the 7th or something? Something around there. And then, okay, great. Well, congratulations on that. That's a great lineup. And it's a great lineup, too.
Mm-hmm.
I was noticing quite a few films in there that look spectacular, including yours. Do you want to give a little bit of a synopsis of First of All?
Yes. First of All is about these two young Libyan Canadians that had been, you know, they grew up in Libya, but they've been studying Canada and living there for many years, planning to make a life there.
30-ish, I guess?
They're...
Younger?
Yeah, they're younger. One, Tariq is 21, and Hamid is 26.
Oh, that really is young.
They're,
okay.
Yeah, they're very young.
Yeah.
And as many people were doing when the Arab Spring started and Tunisia and Egypt happened, they were watching this and waiting for Libya to happen.
Yeah.
And once they saw that people were out on the streets and then getting killed in Libya, and their friends and their family were in Libya, they felt this call that they had to go back to their home country and fight, even though they had never picked up a gun. Even in the film, they say the only thing they've ever done, you know, is play Call of Duty, and that's the only experience that they've had. But they get on an airplane and they head to Libya.
Right.
And the film follows them for their journey on the ground and follows up
the Rebel Army.
The Rebel Army.
This has been going on for decades, you know. There's been wars continuously everywhere. And it feels much more immediate because of that these young men are seeing their family and friends in real time through mm-hmm. social media and whatnot, as well as communication, of course, being so immediate, right? So there's an immediacy for them to go home, which, you know, is a little different than reading headlines maybe on newspapers. I don't know. Do you feel like that played a part in fueling their motivation?
Yeah, I think it did. I mean, Tim and I have talked about this before because, you know, we had worked together in Egypt, and then when Libya happened and going across, you know, watching it unfold on computers was even, you know, strange for us. And we knew, I mean, we talked about the first time, what was the first time you knew that this was different? The one video that you saw, Tim, that you knew that this was going to be like a very different type of, you know, revolution in the Arab Spring.
Oh, the picking for the...
Yeah.
Did that make the film in the end?
No, they didn't make the film, but...
Right. Which is... What were you referring to?
It was a POV shot. It was someone who had taken a mobile phone and had cracked the blinds ever so slightly of their... while hiding inside their apartments and filming out into the streets. And although it was shaky and you could hear whispering voices in the background, whispering in Arabic, very nervous, clearly, you could see... Gaddafi's military convoys, or militias, actually, driving through the streets. And the immediacy that you talk about, it was almost palpable through this YouTube video of the terror that the civilians were experiencing, that they were about to enter into a war. And they really... The scary thing was that these militias were run by Colonel Gaddafi, one of the most sort of terrifying...
Villains,
character-esque almost,
right?
Of our recent dictatorial history, and I found that very, very moving, very effective, and terrifying. And that's something that you wouldn't be able to see until perhaps after the fact, before.
How did you guys meet up? What's the backstory in terms of deciding to collaborate on the project?
Yeah, I had been living and working in Cairo for about 8 months before the Egyptian Revolution happened.
Mm-hmm.
And Tim has been working for PBS Frontline for over a decade, covering wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was sent to Egypt to cover the revolution there. And they found me on the ground, and so I got really lucky and was able to...
There.
I was living there, yeah. And so I was able to work with PBS and meet Tim, and, you know, I had no experience before then working in any type of conflict situation. So I was soaking up all the information that I could and, you know, talking to Tim about how you work in these situations that, you know, when there's groups that are out in the way they were in Egypt, you have to be, you know, very careful about the energy that's happening. So after Egypt was over, which, you know, was quite quick compared to what everybody had thought it might be, Libya started unfolding, and had Tim come back to New York, and I had decided that I wanted to go to Libya, mm-hmm. and I had a week-long assignment to do there. And going in, we, you know, thought it was going to be like Tunisia and Egypt, which only lasted a couple weeks, and then it clearly turned into something very different, and, you know, it turned into 2 months, three, four, five, and Tim had been, you know, still that person that I needed to talk to about the story on the ground, and we would communicate through Skype and, mm-hmm. you know, satellite phones and getting advice about what to do on the front line or if I should even go.
Yes. It should be clear that this was very much Rachel Beth Anderson's film. She was one on the ground for 6-7 months following these guys from beginning to end for the entire uprising until the fall of Gaddafi. And I was very much in Brooklyn on the other end of Skype thinking I'm too old for this and just sort of giving advice and mostly thinking about everything that I've done in the last decade of conflict reporting and using that to suggest to Rachel to not do pretty much anything that I had done. And one of the main reasons is
Are you saying you put yourself off in without thought in harm's way?
Say that again?
You put yourself in harm's way without thinking very much about it, or you were running on,
I think that when you're covering a war, let me start again. When you're a conflict reporter, there is a sort of a feeling to be as close to the conflict itself as possible. And the problem is with that is you become lost within what they call the fog of war. I mean, rarely do you ever see an enemy. Rarely do you understand where you're going. You are often traveling with young soldiers, somewhat cannon fodder or pawns, one might say, who, you know, I was taking orders from a hierarchy up. Know very little about what's actually happening. They're just faced with an immediacy, but of course at very high risk. I think avoiding that is a good thing to do, and that's what Rachel did. So I guess I should get to the point. The point being that what's really interesting about the Libyan Revolution, I found, was these videos that were surfacing on the web, where a lot of them were filmed by mobile phones and poor quality mobile phones. They still didn't have like iPhone 4, iPhone 5 didn't exist,
right.
HD. On
little flip phones, right?
Because their technology, you know, under Gaddafi's rule for, you know, 4 decades, they were really limited to the access of what they could, you know, the technology they could have from outside.
Right.
So you didn't see like you had an Egypt HD capabilities on phones yet, and people were still on tape. And that's just something you don't see now in Syria.
Mm-hmm.
So Libya was, you know, that stepping stone in citizen journalism and people realizing that they could now be effective with what they are capturing.
But then slowly, with the buildup of images that were gathering on the net, more and more higher resolution telephones, even video cameras started coming in. And what we found was there was a great proportion of these young revolutionaries who were there solely to film and to document what the fighters there
that,
that we're doing. And it occurred to me that it really wasn't in Rachel's best interest as far as a filmmaker, as far as story gathering, as far as documenting goes, to necessarily be in the firefights. Why do that when you already have these guys going out there doing it themselves? They're going to get stronger images. They're going to be closer to the situation. They'll have a better understanding than anything you could get.
And as you said before, a little bit of the distance gives you more, maybe a broader perspective. You don't get stuck in the fog of war, and you can kind of create the story and figure out what's happening and kind of and then address it. And from a documentary filmmaker point of view, I guess.
Yeah, I think the most interesting thing was what would happen when they would turn their own cameras off, when they figured like the action's over and you know, we're going to chill out for the rest of the day. That's when I would be there to turn my camera on and really capture what the transformations and the story that was happening away from, you know, the battlefield. You know, there was a limit of what I would put myself in. And as Tim said, you know, don't feel the pressure to go. And when you go because it's necessary for your story, and you get in and you get out. And really that is something I held on to because this was my first war, and I needed to have that sensibility, you know, in my head at all times to at least have a little bit of, you know, feeling of a safety net that there was somebody that was watching my back, even if they were through Skype. You know, I was able to depend on the advice from somebody that I respected and who's been doing this for so long.
There seemed to be a delay, right, in terms of NATO getting involved. Did that play a central part in the timeline? I clearly it did. You mentioned the other conflict areas between Egypt and what have you, and this one seemed to be far more delayed.
Yeah, I think
many
it was,
lives were obviously lost in that delay.
I mean, at one point, I think it was about 3 weeks that I had been on the ground, about a month after the revolution had started, and all the journalists, we were all in Benghazi, and people started getting panicky and realizing, you know, we're hearing that Gaddafi's forces were going to flank the city of Benghazi, blocked the road out, and that they were going to come in with the, you know, the planes. And there was just this sense of urgency to get out. But then I remember just feeling so heartbroken because I was very much attached to the story of what was happening in Libya and to the people there that I had met. And I did not want to leave. But that was not the smart thing. At that point, I wasn't working for anybody. I was just a freelancer who had this idea that I wanted to do. And, you know, AP was leaving. And when AP leaves, you should be leaving. But I did call Tim and ask what I should do, if I should, you know, find a way to stay, because some journalists were staying and I wanted to, is this important for the story? Do you remember what you told me?
I probably told you to get out.
Yeah. And with the other journalists that I was there with, he, you know, he talked. I remember I was sitting across from one of my Betsy Heil, who is a very well-respected journalist and who's lived in Cairo for over a dozen years. And I had come in with her, and I was sitting across from her. And Tim was like, he's like, if you don't leave with Betsy, you're gonna have a problem. And she had already told me she was gonna put me over her shoulder and drag me out of there. But there's just, I felt this responsibility as a journalist to stay, because so many people were leaving. I mean, that's what was the huge proponent to get me back. I was in Cairo for about 10 days, and as soon as the no-fly zone was passed and, you know, they weren't allowed, Gaddafi's forces were kind of under control again, I went back in.
I think one of the important things of documenting war is to separate yourself from the adrenaline rush of the adventure of reporting to actually getting the story. And that, of course, one thing I'd say to Rachel regularly is there's no point going to get a story if you can't come home to tell it. And that's our responsibility.
Yeah, but she the way she described her experience was more of an emotional attachment to and an allegiance of sorts rather than the adrenaline part of just being near the action, you know. But of course, that may just be the way one describes it, and, you know, maybe there's both things going on at the same time. Likely is that's the case. But was there a sense that basically Libya was being abandoned by, and that's what it sounds like Libya was just kind of an abandoned case, where they were, everybody was pulling out, and NATO wasn't responding. I don't know. That's what it seemed like.
It did seem that. And I think you had that sense on the ground that all of the Libyan people were like, you guys are all leaving us. And they understood the importance of having journalists there because they needed to get their story out.
And this is your first war, so you hadn't been hard bitten, you know, like, is that the expression? But where you have, you know, I've been through this enough times, I'm getting out of here.
I didn't.
Where you develop a shell of sorts, you know.
Exactly. You know, this seemed like it was so urgent to get out what was happening, and I couldn't believe that not more people were talking about Libya back home, and people in back home in North Dakota didn't know where Benghazi was, you know. And which sounds so silly, but when you're in the middle of it and you see people suffering, I mean, that's why I ended up staying on the ground for 7 months in the end, because once I got back in there, and again, you know, Benghazi, it was a story because there was a no-fly zone and everybody came back. But then quickly people moved on again, as news cycles do. And I remember feeling so frustrated that people were dying, the war clearly wasn't over, and journalists were leaving. And that is why I wanted to say and have this visual document and tell their story and really make sure that there was somebody that was, you know, bearing witness to what was happening.
Right.
Also at that time, there was a certain amount of what was described back here as, by some journalists, as Arab Spring fatigue, meaning that there would be a lot of coverage of Tunisia, there'd be a lot of coverage of Egypt, and by the time the Libyan revolution, people felt they'd already seen that story. And unfortunately, I think it's very underrated in the history of the whole so-called Arab Spring, and that this was when what we found is that each dictator would learn a little bit more from the previous uprising.
They could leverage the mistakes of their
precisely
their brothers in arms.
And in this case, Gaddafi decided to turn his weapons on his own people, and that hadn't necessarily happened prior to this. And now, as you see in Syria, which is a full-scale civil war, that was the next step to follow.
I see. Yeah. As far as being a filmmaker and approaching it as a filmmaker, you chose to follow two friends, right? These Canadian Libyans, Tariq and Hamid, who are very compelling characters. They're very close friends, right, who decide to go back together. Hamid is a little bit more of a type A, I guess you could say. I don't know. I'm generalizing.
Yeah.
And Tariq is a baby-faced kind of guy, leans towards bright-colored shirts and, you know, right? And, it, you know, seems to be a little bit more of a genteel on some level, I guess, you know?
Yeah, he comes across, he's just so sweet.
Right.
You know, and Tariq was the first one that I had met as well. And I just knew, you know, he was, you know, he didn't know really why I wanted to follow him. I had to gain his trust. I mean, I had to hang out with Tariq and his buddies for about a week without my camera.
Was this still in Canada?
No, this is in Libya. Yeah, okay. This is because his family was living in the western part of Libya, and he was scared that if anybody saw his face that they would be targeted, and they were living in a Gaddafi-controlled area. Mm-hmm. So after I gained his trust, I was able to film him, but only from the nose down.
And, oh, really?
You know, after watching the film, now you might think with certain scenes that you see where you can tell there's some creative editing to work around that.
Right.
But they would check my camera. So eventually they allowed me to film them full screen once I gained their trust. And I think trust was the most important thing that I had to have with them as well.
Sure.
Because eventually going to the front line with them and following them to Misrata, following them to, you know, their next step in their own journeys was, you know, I had to place a lot in what they were going to put me through, basically, and where I was going to go in their story, because I never thought I would be on the ground for as long as I was. That was a surprise for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, but Hamid was, you know, I knew Tariq would be a lovely person on camera, and then as soon as Hamid, you know, when I got introduced to him, he was that person that, you know, he was like that big brother that just drives you absolutely crazy, but everybody loves him. You know, he was that magnetic person that kind of pulled everybody in, and everybody wanted his attention. And, you know, you could see that they really cared about each other and this very big little brother type of, you know, relationship. So they ended up being a great way to really focus in on that microcosm of what actually happened in Libya, rather than really focusing on the politics or focusing on, you know, the day-to-day battles or the entire country. I really wanted, you know, we made that decision to focus on everything comes from their POV, the entire film.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't affect them, really, we didn't focus on it very much because we wanted to make you feel like you were with them in the airplane, with them on the boat, sitting next to them in the car, you know, crawling on the ground with them on the front line. It was very much about allowing somebody that will, you know, would never go to Libya, never be in, you know, in a war, feel like they were a part of it.
Sure, sure. I mean, these guys essentially become your avatars, or you, meaning the audience. I noticed that your film, one of the producers is Mike Lerner, who is a who's on Pussy Riot films.
Yes.
So I guess he leans towards human rights topics as a filmmaker.
Well, I met Mike. Uh-huh. I was introduced to him through Dan Funk Dennis, and actually Tim had introduced me to Dan Funk, so Frontline. And I had left the second time I left Libya, I went out to the UK. I took a, you know, fishing boat
to
Malta.
To Helen back again.
And Mike had seen just my rushes when I was, you know, still had two more months left of filming in Libya, and said, okay, I see what you're doing. And he was one of the first producers that really believed in what I could do. So it was great just to know that there was somebody that saw that I was, that I actually had characters and a storyline.
Oh, I just mentioned Mike Lerner because I haven't met him, I don't think, but I've had on his co-director of Pussy Riot on a couple of times. Matt Maxim.
Yeah, he's actually co-directed
Mr. Boot
with my other producer.
Notorious Mr. Boot?
Oh. Yeah, Tony Gerber from Market Road Films.
Okay, yeah, I noticed his name too, and I was saying, why does that name look so familiar? The Notorious Mr. Boot is going to be at BAM Cinema Fest also, I think, concurrently with Human Rights Watch. It's a busy time of the summer, I guess.
But, I mean, the interesting thing was I came to New York with a suitcase full of hard drives after filming this whole time and, you know, knew that Mike had believed in me, you know, he wanted to do something, but gave myself 2 weeks and then found another crazy producer who came on board as well. So Tony and Mike, you know, decided to help me make this happen.
Pull it all together.
Well, I think it's a tough world. As you must have discussed many times on your program, it's a tough world out there for a first-time filmmaker, and particularly a young first-time filmmaker. And it's hard to convince that you have the gift to pull off a product that the producers think is sellable.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you talk about your film like that then? I mean,
that's something I've definitely learned these past 3 years. And, you know, I've had to go through lots of editorial checks at the beginning, you know, with different people that I was speaking to, and have to, you know, I had to edit lots of small little teasers. And, you know, you do one and then they'd ask for another, you know, edit something else. And this is all just straight out of coming out of Libya after being there for so long, just finding that energy to convince somebody. But I think it's because I've been so passionate about this film that does help make them believe me at first. It gets their attention at least. And, you know, I know that, you know, I've been lucky because I did this very roundabout way. You know, now I know, hey, I should have probably applied for some grants or went to these pitch competitions. But I didn't know that existed because I came from a background of journalism. And so becoming a filmmaker was something I eventually wanted to do, but I didn't realize it was going to happen so fast and that the Arab Spring was really something that happened and I took advantage. And, you know, I found these stories that no one else was telling. And that's why I knew that this needed to be done, and I haven't given up through all the crazy roller coaster that this film process has been.
It's been started
filming in February 2011, so it's been a long road.
And despite all the Arab Spring fatigue, you have finished the film and it's coming out. Rachel, where are you from?
Originally North Dakota.
North Dakota, really? And Tim?
I'm from Australia, actually.
Oh, you are? Okay.
Yeah.
When did you move to New York?
I moved to New York about 4 years ago. Uh-huh. Prior to that, I'd lived in Paris for 9 years.
Sorry about that. That must have been rough.
Yeah. It's funny how many people say that. I remember the first time when I just moved to New York, and people would say, where were you before? I'd say Paris. And they'd say, why?
I was being ironic, though. That's the difference. I was. That sounds like a dream, but you know.
Oh no, it was a dream. I think people were unsure why I'd left Paris because.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, that makes more sense. I'm a little slow. Yeah. Okay, very good. Well, again, the film is called First to Fall, and the directors are Rachel Beth Anderson, and I noticed it. The way it's positioned, you're listed more frequently as a co-director.
Yeah.
Tim, but you both are on the creative
I
team
mean,
here.
Filmmakers,
right. The co-filmmakers behind First of All.
I didn't actually get on the ground until Tripoli had fallen. And then we went in and we did the interviews and saw what happened after that in the hunt for Gaddafi. But my role was mostly in the edit suite.
Understood. Well, I'm glad you're both safe and sound and here in the comfortable backyard here in Brooklyn. I don't know if I described it very well, but you're both safe and sound. That's the important part back home here. And I recommend it. First to Fall, it's going to be, again, at the Human Rights Watch Film Festival.
The HRW Film Festival.
HRWFilmFestival.org. Yes.
I think I'm not sure if you Google it,
I'll put it in the intro or yeah. the, I want something. We'll make sure people know, or the link in the notes and everything. Make sure people know how to get tickets for First to Fall. Thank you guys so much for coming on the show. It was a pleasure to meet you both.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thanks for having us.
Recently, just this past week, we finally decided just to put all the back episodes of FilmWax Radio on iTunes. So as embarrassing as some of those earlier episodes are, because I was awful, I mean, I don't know, whatever you think of me today, I'm a little bit more savvy. I kind of know how to present what I need to present, generally speaking. Not that I don't occasionally flub and drop the ball and all that, I'm sure I do. Back then, I just didn't know what I was doing, and I kind of knew not to talk over the guests. I kind of knew to let them do most of the talking, even though this was always supposed to be a conversational show, not strictly an interview show. But I still talked too much and talked and interrupted. And again, I probably still do it. And, you know, I'm sorry. But I make sure to give them lots of opportunities to get in, out everything they need to get out. And I don't rush anybody anymore. Also, for those who have started tuning into the podcast much more recently, when I started FilmWax Radio, it was actually part of an internet radio enterprise. And I was in a slot. I had a half-hour slot. Then I got 2 half-hour slots back-to-back. So I had to make each... I could have gone 1 hour with the show, but I thought that might be too long for many of the guests. So what I decided to do was to make each show 1 half-hour. So every week I would try to get to 2 shows. And but I had to be strictly at, like, you know, 25 minutes, because you had to have the intro, the outro, all that stuff. So, and because it was in a slot, you know, I... you know, as part of a whole bunch of other shows. And so I had to keep that in mind. And eventually we had, I moved the show over to where it is now with Rooftop Films, because I just thought it would work. There was a partnership that seemed to be mutually beneficial as well as just a place where more people would find the show, what I was trying to do. And so that's the situation. So when you go back and you listen to them, they're shorter, the episodes, I'm not very, I'm not as prepared, I'm not as knowledgeable, I'm not a marketing person, you know, I've sort of developed and evolved with all the inherent, you know, maybe negatives to it. Maybe I've lost some of that, goofiness, I don't know what would have been lost. Anyway, now you can check them out all the way back to, literally to episode 1, which was with filmmaker Zachary Levy, who made a film called Strong Man a few years ago. And that movie is available through most digital platforms today. You could see it. Most of the films that we talk about through going back to even as far as back as episode 1 are movies you can see. And if you have an interest, if you've heard of a movie, you can't find it, just contact me at adam@filmwax.com. I'll help you find it. And you can always email for me for anything, whether it's that or something else. My email again is adam@filmwax.com. You can, of course, also post a message to me. I'm on Facebook,
And you can find the Film Wax Radio page on Facebook as well at facebook.com/filmwaxradio. And, of course, tweet. We tweet under the @filmwaxradio handle. And I try to tweet at least once a day or two times a day, three times a day, depending on how industrious I am. But we are out there. And you can now also go to our website. We are only keeping the current show on the homepage right now. Eventually, the idea, I guess, would be to move the archive over to there. But we're building this slowly. And when I say we, I mean me and Herbert. So the two of us are kind of working on this project over time. So what, like, one thing I want to do is, like, recently I sat down with Jonathan Couette, who made Tarnation and Walk Away Renee and a few other films, and he lives here in New York, and he's become a friend, and he is doing a series at the Wythe Hotel later in the month, which we're going to talk about on that podcast, the next show. Jonathan and I spoke for over an hour and a half, and a lot of it was not about his film series that he's doing or film at all, and we just kind of rambled on, and I don't know if that would be a whole ton of fun for everybody, but there are probably quite a few people who might want to hear it. So what I'm going to do is I'll put a more edited version into the podcast, that one that you're listening to now, that it streams through Rooftop, through iTunes, and then on my website, filmwaxradio.com, we'll put the full episode. And we also, I did the same thing with Brian Wiseman. That show is also coming up next week. It's a long, extended conversation, but it might be a little long for some people who are trying to just sort of understand what he's doing. He has a Kickstarter for his latest project, and we talk about that as well as other things. So there you go. So check it out, filmwaxradio.com. There's the blog. There's ways you can subscribe, of course, to the email, and there's other things. And more will be added over time as we expand the site in the coming months. Again, feedback is welcome, and you can write me at adam@filmwax.com. So there you have it. So we'll be seeing you at Northside Film Festival. That's coming up Monday through, I think, Thursday next week, the 16th through the 19th, at various venues in North Brooklyn, including Nighthawk Cinema, the Wythe Hotel, Indie Screen, and Union Docks, just to name a few. Check out the Northside Film Festival website, though, for all the details. There's lots of music going on as of today, as well as their Innovation events, which is the third sort of component to this festival. It's called Innovation. And also, BAM Cinema Fest begins shortly next week. It will begin later in the week, and I'll be going to a number of the events there, but as a spectator. So if I run into you, say hello. And continuing, of course, at various Rooftop Films events throughout the summer. Thanks so much, everybody. This is Adam Chartoff, your host, Film Wax Radio, presented by Rooftop Films, wishing you well in the upcoming days and weeks and months in your life. Till next time.
Sunday morning through Bakersfield, listening to gospel music on the colored radio station, and the preacher said, you know, you always have the Lord by your side. And I was so pleased to be informed of this that I ran 20 red lights in his honor. Thank you, Jesus. Thank you, Lord. I had an arrangement to meet a girl, and I was kind of late. And I thought by the time I got there, she'd be off.